This is a recording of the special hearing on electioneering communication held by the Federal Election Commission on October 17th and 18th, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
I'm going to reconvene the meeting of the Federal Election Commission for October 17th, 2007. We have our third and final panel today. It consists of Jessica Robinson, here on behalf of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and Paul Ryan, who is here on behalf of the Campaign Legal Center. I believe you're both in the room before, but just as a refresher, you'll have 5 minutes for an opening statement at the beginning. We have a light display in front of you. The green light will be on during your five-minute time period until the last minute, at which point it will begin to flash. With 30 seconds left, the yellow light will come on, and the red light will indicate that your time has expired. Again, we will go alphabetically, and with two people whose name begins with R, we move to the second letter. And so, Ms. Robinson, you will get to go first, and Mr. Ryan will follow. So, Ms. Robinson, at your convenience.
Well, I am delighted to be here on behalf of the 1.4 million members of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I hope to be helpful to you in conforming your regulations to the Supreme Court's decision here in WRTL2. I have to say I was surprised at the breadth of the court's decision, and I would urge the commission to resist any attempts to narrow it or constrain the amount of speech that is protected under the court's opinion. Which brings me directly to the proposed safe harbor for grassroots lobbying communications. I find the idea of a safe harbor, I find it very appealing in theory. I worry about how it may be applied in practice. My fear is that when the government tells you that there is a permissible way of speaking, that it becomes the only permissible way of speaking, that it becomes a device for shifting the burden from the speaker, shifting the burden from the government to the speaker. And, a union or corporation may run an ad that is not the functional equivalent of express advocacy, but because it doesn't fall within that safe harbor, they're left dealing with complaints explaining why protected speech is protected speech. Or they're left responding to complaints and explaining why their protected speech is protected speech. You may not view this as a huge burden for unions and corporations, but I want to remind you that there are a lot of small local unions without in-house lawyers who have to waste resources paying for a lawyer to explain to the government why lawful speech is lawful speech. And in my experience, the lesson learned in this area by those with limited resources is not to speak, or to speak only in the way that the government says is appropriate. What I'm getting at here is I think that the proposed safe harbor for grassroots lobbying communications is too narrow. That's not to say that the entire universe of communications protected under WRTL2 should fall within the safe harbor, but if the commission is going to take the time and effort to draft to prepare a safe harbor and codify it, that you should at least make it useful to the people it's supposed to protect. You know, it should be more of a shield for the speaker and less of a sword for the censor. Along that line, I would also urge the commission to reject proposals to specify in the rules discrete content constituting strong evidence or some other term that would specifically say when an ad is not protected by WRTL2 unless, you know, that is express advocacy. I don't really see any reason to adopt that type of language unless the purpose of it is to create a presumption of guilt on the part of the speaker that has to be rebutted, which I believe under WRTL, the court clearly states that it is the burden of the government to show that they have a compelling interest in regulating a particular ad. And on the matter of whether to adopt alternative one or alternative two for disclosure, AFSCME supports the adoption of Alternative 2. My colleague, Larry Gold, I think he did a fine job of explaining our position on that point. But I just want to press the point that the jurisprudence in this area shows that disclosure is really, it's generally limited, mandatory disclosure is generally limited to disclosing funds used to pay for ads that are regulable by the government. But if the commission decides not to adopt Alternative 2 and instead adopts Alternative 1, I beg of you to simplify the disclosure requirements. Again, Mr. Gold made a, I think he did a good job of presenting to you the issues in this area. And, you know, it's really the breadth of the definition of donation. What is a donation? Is it, you know, is it interest? Is it royalties? Is it dues? And I don't want to get into the arcane complexities of dues structures for labor unions, but when you're using dues to report that they were spent for something, it's hard to identify who the donor is. Is it the dues payer, or is it the affiliated labor union who's required to pay per capita taxes? So I think the easiest way to address these issues is to require reporting only for those people who earmark funds to be used for WRTL2 type communications, or and other funds should be reported just as a donation of the labor union.
Thank you. Mr. Ryan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, fellow commissioners. It's a pleasure to be here this afternoon on behalf of the Campaign Legal Center. There are two issues that I believe are key issues in this rulemaking. I want to address both of them briefly in my opening remarks. One is the question of whether to exempt WRTL-type ads from the BCRA disclosure requirements. The second one is whether the WRTL decision requires a change to the FEC's definition of expressly advocating, found at Section 100.22 of the Commission's regulations. With respect to the first point, the disclosure point, commenters opposing exempting WRTL-type ads from BCRA's disclosure requirements through this rulemaking include, on the one hand, the Center for Competitive Politics, Professor Allison Hayward, who you heard from this morning, Mr. Bob Bauer, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And on the other hand, you have a group with which this first group very rarely agrees with on matters of campaign finance law. You have Senators McCain, Feingold, Snow, and Representative Shays. You have my organization, the Campaign Legal Center, which filed comments jointly with Democracy 21, the Brennan Center for Justice, Common Cause, League of Women Voters, and U.S. PERC. You have Public Campaign. You have Public Citizen. You have Professors Hassan and Brafal. These commenters undoubtedly have varying opinions regarding how the Supreme Court would and should resolve a legal challenge to BCRA's electioneering communication disclosure requirements, but two things they all agree on are, one, that the Supreme Court in McConnell upheld BCRA's electioneering communication disclosure requirements against facial challenge by a vote of 8-1, and two, BCRA's electioneering communication disclosure requirements were not challenged in WRTL, and consequently, the Supreme Court did not consider or decide the legal question of whether WRTL-type ads may constitutionally be subject to disclosure requirements. And indeed, WRTL's complaint stated explicitly, quote, WRTL does not challenge the reporting and disclaimer requirements for electioneering communications, only the prohibition on using its corporate funds for its grassroots lobbying advertisements, unquote. And this is a point that was repeatedly stressed by WRTL in its brief to the Supreme Court. It was also raised at oral argument. Mr. Bopp assured the court that WRTL's challenge to the statute, if successful, would leave a fully transparent system. And in addition to these widely agreed upon facts, namely that the plaintiff in WRTL did not challenge the disclosure requirements, the WRTL court did not address the constitutionality of these disclosure requirements, and the McConnell court by large majority specifically upheld the constitutionality of these disclosure requirements, the Campaign Legal Center urges consideration of three other reasons why the commission should refrain from and not alter BCRA's disclosure requirements in this rulemaking. First, fundamentally different constitutional tests apply to funding restrictions and disclosure requirements. whereas a reporting requirement is constitutional so long as there is a relevant correlation or a substantial relation between the governmental interest and the information required to be disclosed. A restriction on political spending is constitutional only if it meets the more rigorous strict scrutiny requirement of being narrowly tailored to further a compelling government interest. That's the first reason. Second reason is that broader, different governmental interests, public information interests, as opposed to the Austin-type corporate corruption interests, support disclosure requirements. Third, the burden on those subject to disclosure requirements is lesser than the burden on those subject to restrictions on expenditures. As the Buckley Court stated, quote, unlike the overall limitations on contributions and expenditures, the disclosure requirements impose no ceiling on campaign-related activities, unquote. The Buckley Court noted that, quote, disclosure requirements, certainly in most applications, appear to be the least restrictive means of curbing the evils of campaign ignorance and corruption that Congress found to exist, unquote. And I'm going to conclude this first point by taking a welcomed opportunity to quote Allison Hayward's comments, because it's a very rare occasion that we actually agree with one another on anything with regarding to campaign finance law. Professor Hayward wrote in her comments, "The Commission should promulgate regulations to reflect this opinion and not venture to predict how or whether the court would extend the same analysis to disclosure laws, which are typically subject to less rigorous scrutiny. It is better for the Commission's litigation record and more appropriate to its role as a federal agency to adopt a rule that hews closely to the court's holding." With respect to the second question, whether the WRTL decision requires a change to the FEC's definition of expressly advocating at section 100.22 of the Commission's regulations, the Commission correctly notes in the NPRM that the court's equating of the functional equivalent of express advocacy with communications that are susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate bears considerable resemblance to components of the Commission's definition of express advocacy, and the Campaign Legal Center agrees with this. Subpart B standard of the WRTL test is virtually identical to the Subpart B standard from the Commission's regulations are virtually identical and indistinguishable from the WRTL test. The Commission has been applying this test recently in the context of 527 enforcement actions. We think the Commission has got it right in that respect with regard to the 527 conciliation agreements, and we encourage the Commission to interpret this decision as an affirmation of the constitutionality of the Subpart B express advocacy test. Thank you. I look forward to answering any questions you might have.
Good. Thank you. Questions from the Commission? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Ms. Robinson, and by the way, I should have said this when Mr. Gold was here also, since I think he was involved in drafting this comment, but as an undergraduate of MIT, I was very much appreciated the comment where he said that if we define a class of communications that lies between express advocacy and the universe, that would be the equivalent of the dark matter of the universe, and I thought that was a very interesting comment. My question is, you were worried in your testimony about the safe harbors becoming basically the only way to fit within the exemption, and I wonder whether, if we added language that said something like that among communications that satisfy the exemption are the following that fit within these paragraphs, or something like, after giving examples of safe harbor, saying something like, although a communication may be a permissible communication, even if it doesn't satisfy either safe harbor. I mean, would that go a long way towards satisfying your concern or worry about that?
I certainly think that would be helpful. If you know, in a preface to the safe harbor, you said that the whole of WRTL2 communications is not reflected by the safe harbor. I would also appreciate a statement that makes it clear that it is the burden is on the Commission to show that the communication is not protected under WRTL2.
How would we do that? How would we prove that there is no possible reasonable interpretation? Isn't that only sort of proving a negative? It's a practical problem that I struggled with a little bit as we were drafting this thing. I mean, I think that your interpretation of what the Supreme Court is telling us is true.
Right.
But in terms of, as a practical matter, as we task our lawyers to brief this up for us, it does present them with a particular problem that it's hard to figure out how they would solve.
It is. It is a difficult task that you have. And, I think, I don't know how you, I do not know how to prove a negative. I have had experience where that has been the task that's been placed before me by the commission. and so I can tell you that it is a very hard thing to do. In drafting a safe harbor, if you're going to do it, I think a good thing to do is to use some examples. I would just... It's impossible to show never. I mean, especially when you're stuck with this situation where there's a reasonable interpretation involved.
Okay, that is just hopeful, given Commissioner von Spakovsky's reference to the dark matter, that there might have been breakthroughs. Mr. Ryan, I've got a question for you. Mr. Bopp's, I think, approach to us is somewhat... somewhat more subtle than what I know. It's kind of odd to use that word in reference to Mr. Bopp's testimony earlier today, but it's, I think his point is right, which is not that so much that that is a matter of constitutional law, Congress could not pass a disclosure regime for these sorts of communications, but that in briefing this matter up to the Supreme Court, he was seeking an as-applied challenge. He had an as-applied challenge for which he thought he would get an exemption from the electioneering provisions, and instead he got what he interpreted to be a redefinition of what an electioneering communication was. And as a consequence, as a matter of policy, it's reasonable for us to take that the definition of what constitutes an electioneering communication and take those things that fall outside of it and have them simultaneously fall outside of the disclosure regime and consequently, as is pointed out by the commenters, the coordination regimes. And that this is entirely appropriate as a matter of policy because the court has highlighted that these ads consist in many cases of lobbying communications that would not normally be regulated by the Federal Election Commission or genuine issue speech, which also, but for their timing and reference to the candidate, would not be regulated by us either. And so I think it is sort of in much more out of a sense of the a desire to fairly interpret what the Supreme Court is doing and also to sort of cleave to the policy, goals and guidelines that Congress has set for this agency that animates or motivates the thinking about whether the changes to the regulations that flow from this decision should fall into the Section 114 and the regulations of expenditures by labor organizations and corporations or into the definitions of what constitutes an electioneering communication. And in your comments, you focus on the constitutional concerns, as did a number of other commenters, because I think that what was sort of animating our thinking in this probably wasn't as apparent from the notice and the proposed rulemaking as it could have been. But I'd like you to turn to that problem, which we discussed with him a little earlier and with the panel earlier, and whether the court isn't really, in Wisconsin Right to Life, telling us what an electioneering communication is, and then and as a consequence, to the degree that these things are not electioneering communications, they should appropriately fall outside of our regime for electioneering communications.
I think that the disagreement, this particular disagreement between Mr. Bopp's position and the Campaign Legal Center's position, relates perhaps in large part to our understanding of what the court did. And I believe that the court did not hold that WRTL's ads were not related to an election, and instead the court held that WRTL's ads are susceptible to another equally reasonable interpretation, and that such dual interpretation ads cannot constitutionally be subject to BCRA's spending or funding restrictions. The court gave no indication as to whether dual interpretation ads could constitutionally be subject to disclosure requirements. They did address that issue in McConnell, and in McConnell, the court held that on its face, any ads that meet the definition could be subject to disclosure, the disclosure requirements in BCRA. So, at the end of the day, I think there's a temptation here by Mr. Bopp and others to say these ads that were at issue in WRTL, these are grassroots lobbying ads. These are not in the election ad box. When what I think is more accurately the case is that these are dual interpretation ads. These are ads that were argued all the way up to the Supreme Court as having at least a purpose of influencing elections, and Mr. Bopp arguing on the contrary. No, they're grassroots lobbying ads, and then an oral argument, I believe Seth Waxman addressed this point explicitly on behalf of the interveners in the case, that our position in the case, as and by our, I mean the defendant interveners, I was part of that legal team, although I'm not representing them here today, but our position in that litigation was that when dealing with dual interpretation ads, we believe they should be subject to both the funding restrictions and the disclosure requirements. Mr. Bopp's position in that litigation on behalf of his client was, we're not challenging the application of the disclosure requirements to such dual interpretation ads. We are challenging the funding restrictions. They should not be subject to them. And the court only ruled on that funding restriction piece of this. The court has not said that these ads are not related to an election.
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, while the ads are susceptible to many interpretations, my assumption has been that the organizations that are funding the, some of them are funding them for lobbying purposes, and some of them are funding them for issues purposes, and some of them may be funding them for electoral purposes. But given the text of the ads, it's not possible to discern that. And as a consequence, there are multiple interpretations, but that the that there is some driving impetus in these organizations, that it may be in some cases that they have multiple purposes.
If I can just respond to that briefly. I was here this morning when you and Mr. Bopp had this conversation, and Mr. Bopp challenged your use of the terms intent and purpose and said the court made clear that that can no longer be considered. And I want to be abundantly clear that we are not suggesting that these are dual-purpose ads. In the aftermath of WRTL, I am referring to these ads as dual interpretation ads, and Congress made the determination when they passed this statute that it believed that any ad that met this statutory definition of electioneering communications had at least as one of its reasonable interpretations as influencing elections or advocating the election or defeat of a candidate. And I think that's what this commission is left with. You're left with Congress's intent to require disclosure of any ad meeting the definition, and the Supreme Court considering the application of that definition in a narrower or different context, which is the funding restriction.
Vice Chairman Mason.
Mr. Ryan, I wanted to ask a question about something Ms. Robinson brought up that was essentially from your comments or your joint comments that I thought was an interesting point, and that's this strong evidence rule. I mean, doesn't that in effect become a chill? And in fact, isn't it kind of intended to be a chill? To put people on notice that, well, you better not say that, because isn't the likely effect of someone using some of the words that that constitute strong evidence to be that they'll have a complaint filed and be subject to investigation by the government?
Yeah, I'm not sure the extent to which speech would be chilled, but I will say that to me,
a
plain reading of Chief Justice Roberts' opinion is that you have this sort of two-tiered test. You have the umbrella test, and then you have the specific characteristics of Wisconsin Right to Life's ads that led the Chief Justice and his colleague who signed his opinion to reach the conclusion that those specific ads were exempt under the umbrella test. I believe that there is some distance between the safe harbor, the exact criteria of Wisconsin Right to Life's ads, and the broader umbrella test. I don't know exactly how to measure that distance or what it is, but I do know that Chief Justice Roberts articulated in his test several indicia of express advocacy and indicated that the absence of these is one of the very important criteria that led him to reach the conclusion he reached.
But the
converse of that is, allow me to just finish very briefly, is that in the presence of such indicia of express advocacy, we aren't sure how Chief Justice Roberts would have come out.
Well, but that leads to exactly the issue that Ms. Robinson brought up, and that, you know, I had asked the questions before in terms of a balancing or something like that, and the problem I see with the approach that you're suggesting is not that there aren't two different things. There clearly are. It's a general test in the application, and there are clearly some ads that will not meet the same application but will be protected by the general test. I think everybody agrees with that. The trouble is that by introducing this strong evidence concept, you do what Ms. Robinson fears, is you push everything back into the safe harbor and you rob the general test of it, of its meaning. And when you say you don't know, I mean, I think we frankly do know in the real world, and your organization will be out there and other organizations will be out there ready to file complaints, which is your right, okay, but that's why I'm asking about what's the basis for this strong evidence test, and isn't in fact going to throw a chill on people, isn't it intended to do that, to kind of push people back and say, look, if you say this, you know, you're going to be subject to government scrutiny.
Look, I strongly suspect that Mr. Bopp wrote along with his clients or advised his clients to write the ads that they wrote for a reason. And Mr. Bopp, I suspect, was looking for ads that he thought he could get in.
I'm not asking about Mr. Bopp. I'm asking about the test that your organizations propounded and why you're supporting that test.
Because in the absence of that strong evidence test, it is quite possible that ads that Chief Justice Roberts himself indicated, Jane Doe type ads, could be exempt under the umbrella and push well beyond. I mean, this margin that we're talking about between the safe harbor and the umbrella is really a margin of where groups will be pushing beyond what Wisconsin Right to Life wanted to do, beyond what the Supreme Court, the actual ads before that the Supreme Court considered in an as-applied challenge. And certainly, to be clear, the court's umbrella test is slightly broader than exactly what Wisconsin Right to Life, the characteristics of its ads, but, you know, we don't know what the difference is, how much room there is. And this commission, for better or worse, has been charged with employing this no reasonable interpretation test at the end of the day. And, you know, there's been discussion of burden shifting. My understanding, given the way this commission's enforcement process works, is that the commission always bears the burden of proving whether in the context of attempting to convince an organization or a person into a conciliation agreement, or if that's unsuccessful, convincing a court that the commission is in the right and that there is no reasonable interpretation other than for a particular ad. I mean, the burden is clearly still on the commission to do this. And, you know, but again, not having this strong evidence elements that we propose in our comments, I think leaves open the distinct possibility that Jane Doe type ads, with which Chief Justice Roberts explicitly distinguished Wisconsin Right to Life's ads from, could possibly get in under the umbrella with very little consideration. We're simply urging the commission to take into consideration whether or not the ads before the commission possess some characteristics that the court in Wisconsin Right to Life did not consider, and to exercise your judgment as you did in the 527 enforcement actions. You exercised it well in those capacities, and I think Don Simon said it earlier, keep doing what you're doing as far as the outcomes you've reached with regard to those ads.
I'm glad you think so, because Mr. Witten was not persuaded.
I just want to comment on something that, on a point that Mr. Ryan made. I do not believe that the Chief Justice applied a two-step test in the case. I believe he used a one-step test, and that test was whether or not the ads at issue were susceptible to a reasonable interpretation as something other than as an appeal to vote for or against a candidate. The indicia of express advocacy and the characteristics of grassroots lobbying ads were something characteristics of the specific ads at issue that he thought made it clear that they didn't fall within that. But that was those indicia and those characteristics were the specific test that Mr. Bopp proffered to the court. Chief Justice Roberts says he rejects that test. Instead, he chooses his own one-step test that he felt was more protective of political speech. And so I think that, in footnote 7, I believe, makes it clear that the court is not requiring any or all of those indicia characteristics.
You know, and in brief response to that, to the extent that this commission were to decide that all it wanted to promulgate as a rule was the umbrella test, one-step test, the Campaign Legal Center wouldn't complain. We believe that the safe harbors provide added guidance and clarity for the regulated community, but we certainly don't think it would be unconstitutional for this commission to adopt a rule saying the exemption, the WRTL-type test, is the umbrella, no reasonable interpretation test. So if that's what members of the regulated community would prefer, so be it.
You know, this talk of the safe harbors and are trying to articulate clearer standards nearly drives me screaming out of the window, in part because I so often hear that our standards are vague and unclear and it provides people with no guidance, and then we go and we try and provide people with greater clarity and more guidance, and we're accused, you know, we're accused of corralling speech into these narrow little pens that we're able to all find four or five or six commissioners to agree on. And it's hard because, you know, we are trying to provide some clear guidance, and yet, you know, I am very aware that people have different levels of willingness to take on risk. And some people are very risk averse, and if the government says, if you do the exact three things here, there's no risk of enforcement, and that's what they want to do. And other people have more a willingness for risk, and they're willing to do something broader. And some people are utterly inattentive to risk, and we see them in enforcement. But the so I think that we are, you know, we obviously were well aware when we put this out that we could simply replicate the Chief Justice's language and be done with it, and it would provide people with no further guidance other than we were aware that the Supreme Court had issued its decision and had read it, or at least that part of it. So the safe harbors and the wrestling with the factors we know brings both a hope that they are helpful and provide clarity, and yet also an awareness that clarity will lead the most risk averse to scurry to that protection. Are there other questions? Then I will continue. I wanted to ask both of you sort of flip sides of a similar question, the same problem, and I'll start with Mr. Ryan. My question is it possible for us to read Wisconsin Right to Life decision and as a consequence the earlier decisions in McConnell and Buckley as telling us anything other than when we look to define express advocacy, we are left with a magic words test? Is it possible to read Wisconsin Right to Life as leaving more there than that, or is that what the court is telling us?
I don't believe that's what the court was telling you, and I think a fair reading of the Wisconsin Right to Life decision is that express advocacy language or communications that meet the Roberts test can be treated as express advocacy. Anything that is express advocacy and or its functional equivalent may be treated as express advocacy. And
well, before you go on, how do we wrestle our way through that little linguistic problem, right? Because there must be some difference.
I don't think it's a huge linguistic problem. I think the important, I use the dreaded word context here, is the important context is that in the McConnell decision where the court was discussing express advocacy and determined or declared that the express advocacy standard was functionally meaningless, I believe that the court was referencing the magic words type interpretation of express advocacy. And I believe the court was doing so because this commission had not relied upon or enforced subpart B of its express advocacy test in many years. It had not done so. My understanding is that it had not done so since the late 90s. In fact, BCRA itself was in large part pushed through Congress or enacted by Congress because of the functionally meaninglessness, if that's a word, of the magic words type express advocacy test. So in the McConnell decision, I think that's what we're talking about. When the court said express advocacy or its functional equivalent, I don't think it was envisioning the subpart B test as part of what it meant by express advocacy.
And doesn't that make our problem harder? Because they're doing so in the context of interpreting a different set of statutory language where Congress had sort of set very clear, you know, numbers of days prior to the election in which the speech could be regulated and then very broad, you know, content restrictions. And in that context, my sense of the McConnell decision was that the court said, well, given these sort of tighter statutory limits and the fact that the magic words test is functionally meaningless, then Congress can constitutionally regulate more precisely in this other way. But it leaves us back in the part of the statute that we're enforcing here in terms of just expenditures and, you know, in general, with the earlier statutory language and potentially with the earlier Supreme Court interpretation of express advocacy as limited to magic words. And my concern is that that's what the Chief Justice was articulating in Wisconsin Right to Life.
You know, what I think is what is different after Wisconsin Right to Life. One of the things that's different after Wisconsin Right to Life is that up until that point in time, we didn't have a firm understanding of the outer bounds constitutionally speaking, the outer bounds of what this commission may regulate in terms of funding restrictions. In Buckley, we had a statutory phrase in the definition of expenditure that the court found to be unconstitutionally vague, and they articulated this express advocacy test in that context. The court made clear in McConnell that back in Buckley, they were not defining a constitutional test there. They were just dealing with an unconstitutionally vague statute. And then they sort of set that aside, and they said, and here we have a statute that is not unconstitutionally vague, so we don't need to necessarily talk about express advocacy in this case. But the test we have here is within the bounds of what's constitutionally permissible in terms of regulating funding restrictions. And then in Wisconsin Right to Life, they're dealing with a funding restriction, and they employed what is essentially an express advocacy test, more broadly defined than magic words, in the context of defining the outer bounds of what this commission can regulate. You know, it went from Buckley only dealing with express advocacy as a means of construing a vague statute to McConnell saying, yeah, everyone wants to talk about express advocacy in Buckley, but this statute isn't vague, so we're not going to worry about it here, to Wisconsin Right to Life saying, yeah, this statute isn't vague, but we, as it turns out, we are kind of worried about the reach of it. We are kind of worried about the commission getting at speech, Congress getting at speech, that the First Amendment prohibits it from getting at, and declared Congress cannot regulate speech with respect to funding restrictions. That is not the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and then they set forth their test. But that's how I see the sequence of events, and I also want to point out that this widespread belief that the subpart B test was not being relied upon by the commission, that I believe the court was relying on in McConnell, I think the parties were relying on in Connell, is also reflected in the Shays 2 litigation, where, you know, getting back, Commissioner Mason mentioned my colleague, Roger Witten, and for the record, I also want to make clear that the Campaign Legal Center doesn't applaud every aspect of the way that the commission has dealt with 527 organizations, and we've made our thoughts clear in another arena and in the litigation on that context. We are happy with the outcome you've reached with respect to analyzing the text of the ads at issue in those cases. But getting back to Shays 2, in Shays 2, the court's decision early on and the papers filed by parties in the case were largely dependent on an understanding and a presumption that this commission was only going to rely on express advocacy, magic, or the magic words part of its express advocacy definition. When the commission made clear through conciliation agreements as well as through a revised explanation and justification that it was, you might say, resurrecting the subpart B standard, the court's concerns were largely allayed at that point, and, you know, for perhaps understandable reasons. But this resurrection of subpart B is something new, and I think it's important not to read too much into the McConnell language saying, you know, express advocacy is this, functional equivalent of it is this, and now in assuming that the Roberts test is something other than and distinct from express advocacy.
Ms. Robinson, the other side of the coin is if Mr. Ryan's wrong and you're right, and we are left, or do we find ourselves in a position where we're left with a test of express advocacy, which the Supreme Court in the McConnell decision considered, you know, functionally meaningless?
Well, I guess what I would say about that is that it may be functionally meaningless, but it's legally significant. You know, what the court is getting at here is that you have these ads that basically they do the same thing, but they are, and so you have these ads that are magic words, and you have these ads that are not, the Yellowtail ad, for instance, I would say is what the court used as an example of something that was not magic words, but would be regulated under the electioneering communications provision. And the court said the distinction between magic words and Bill Yellowtail is functionally meaningless. But the significance is that one of them is that you have this vague statute that is construed to very narrowly so that you're not, so that the commission or the government can't reach speech that may be campaign related, but the public isn't advised about where the line is drawn. So here you have this. And the court knew in Buckley, they said explicitly that they realized that there were going to be a lot of ads that were campaign related that this wasn't going to reach. And so then you get to McConnell, and the court says, you know, we realize this distinction is functionally meaningless. And that is the reason that Congress can use this new standard that is easily understood and objectively determinable to regulate these ads. Now, Congress can always go back and amend FECA to make it also the definitions of expenditure and contribution and political committee, to make those easily understood and objectively determinable. But until they do that, you're stuck with magic words. Now, in this new area, which Congress specifically identified as an attempt to regulate beyond express advocacy, that's where you get your functional equivalent of express advocacy. Because it was a construction on this statute that was already easily understood and objectively determinable.
Vice Chairman Mason.
Functional equivalent of a non-functional test. that's our problem. I understand.
It defines a conundrum.
I suppose the other legal category out there that all the lawyers are taught to think badly of are formal tests. And I think that's sort of the clue to the riddle, that express advocacy is a formal test. And that's, as it were, it's the converse of a functional test isn't a non-functional test, it's a formal test. That's what I'm trying to get at. I wanted to ask Ms. Robinson about dues, and I take it that the monthly dues of a typical individual member are less than $100.
Well, I would say that it depends from union to union. I know that we certainly have members who pay dues that would have to be disclosed on electioneering communications report.
So there are members, in other words, whose dues are in excess of $85 a month or whatever it would be, and more than $1,000 a year.
Yes.
Certainly in ALPA, the airline pilots would. They all would, because they all make a lot of money.
Oh,
right.
Okay. All right.
Screen
you know,
Actors Guild. There are some.
Understand.
Right. And
there are some workforces.
How would
AFSCME
we?
AFSCME certainly represents doctors and dentists and college professors. So.
Didn't I always thought of union workers as?
Most are. There are these pockets.
Right.
The question I want to get at, and I think there's an answer to this, but I want to try to get your help, is how in carving out an exemption for dues payers would we address the problem of the Wiley brothers, who I'm very sympathetic to. I think they were trying to do a nice thing, or at least what they thought was a public-spirited thing. And what if Republicans for Clean Air filed itself a charter and said, to be a member of Republicans for Clean Air, all you have to do is pay dues of $500,000 a year, and the two brothers sign up and they're dues-paying members. How do we deal with that? Because we have these inventive people out there who'll try to use every tool they can to promote their speech interests.
Sure. Well, I suppose one thing that you would look at is donative intent. And assuming that Republicans for Clean Air, whoever they are, they meet your test for membership organization, and so they are not formed for the major purpose of supporting a candidate for political office. It's difficult if the organization does something else. I mean, union dues, they are not donations. They're required for union membership. So I guess one of the ways that you would look at it is you would look at the intent of the members of Republicans for Clean Air. Are they doing it so that the organization can pay for electioneering communications? I would say that that's...
So
certainly
it's one of these things
that
we would have to get into discovery for, and that would be a bad thing.
This is quite true. It is a dilemma.
It's hard here.
It also sounds like an intent-based test.
Well, but we're doing that on the solicitation side, right? right? I mean, the solicitation, it says that the purpose of the solicitation is to fund, you know, the
words.
Federal candidates.
Sure, right.
Well, we're measuring look at the
people,
words.
But we're looking at the speech, yeah, the specific speech that's used to discern what was the purpose of the solicitation.
Well, think about that and see if you can provide us any help, because that's just why I'm in agreement that legitimate dues, that it would be a good thing to exempt, but it's just too easy for me to imagine someone coming up with a membership organization with a dues structure that I've described, and they'll probably have a list of benefits and you know, governing documents that comply with our membership organization rules. And
okay. Further questions?
Nobody else. Mm-hmm. If nobody else.
Yeah, please. Vice Chairman Mason.
Would the two of you address the Gansky ad? And this is the one that says, it's our land, our water, America's environment must be protected. But in just 18 months, Congressman Gansky has voted 12 out of 12 times to weaken environmental protections. Congressman Gansky even voted to let corporations continue releasing cancer-causing pollutants into our air. Congressman Gansky voted for the big corporations who lobbied these bills and gave him thousands of dollars in contributions. Call Congressman Gansky, telling to protect America's environment for our families, for our future. Is that a prohibited electioneering communication or not under the WRTL test?
Well, I certainly don't think it is. I mean, I assume that there are people that would, probably reasonable people that would interpret it as an appeal to vote for or against Greg Gansky. And, you know, I view myself as a reasonable person, and I can interpret it as something other than as an appeal to vote for or against him. In looking at WRTL 2, I really don't see anything in the case that says, you know, you can't compare your position with a candidate's, or you can't create a sense of urgency about a legislative vote that's about to be cast, or you can't engage in hyperbole. I think that there are at least two ways to interpret that ad.
Mr. Ryan?
I, by contrast, do not believe the Gansky ad would be exempt. It's certainly not exempt under the safe harbor. It contains indicia of express advocacy, which would disqualify it from the Safe Harbor Act as the Commission has proposed in the NPRM. But I think beyond that, I would characterize it as really the classic Jane Doe ad, and as a personal attack on the character of the candidate identified. And, you know, this is an ad of the sort, I think, that under the umbrella test, it's going to depend on who's doing the reasonable interpreting. I don't think the ad is susceptible to any reasonable interpretation other than as an effort to oppose a candidate.
What makes it an attack on his character? That was the term you used, or, you know, I suppose under the Roberts test, qualifications or fitness for office?
I would point to the language saying that he took campaign contributions in exchange for his votes, which is an attack on fitness for office, I think, pretty clearly. The ad essentially says that he supports cancer because, after all, he voted to let corporations continue releasing cancer-causing pollutants. You know, this ad is very different from Wisconsin Right to Life's ads. It's also very different from the Christian Civic League of Maine ads that were at issue in other related litigation here. And, you know, but
I understand that. But what I'm trying to understand is this: it's interesting to me that people seem to disagree about whether Chief Justice Roberts intended Jane Doe to be in or out. How would we draw a line between this and any other very pointed criticism of an office holder's votes? I mean, you know, the fact that he voted to continue to let corporations release cancer-causing pollutants, I mean, that's a, you know, probably a factual statement that could be caveated, you know, how? In other words, how many parts per billion or whatever? There could have been competing proposals, and the environmental groups could have had a proposal up there that could be characterized that way because it wasn't a zero threshold, right? So how do we make that distinction?
Well, I think one of the most difficult issues facing the commission now in the aftermath of WRTL is drawing that line, if it's possible to draw a line between criticizing and condemning. And I'm one of those who believe that Chief Justice Roberts intended for Jane Doe type ads to be out. You know, I think he mentioned Jane Doe ads and distinguished Wisconsin Right to Life's ads from Jane Doe ads for a reason, and I think it's important not to ignore that reason. But, you know, this is going to be an ad of the sort that creates, you know, a challenge for the commission. It will come down to whether there is a majority of commissioners who believe that there is a reasonable interpretation other than.
The thing we're struggling with is just this. I mean, we talk about who's the reasonable person here, and and also speculate about what the court is going to do on the next challenge, which isn't very helpful, I mean, in terms of the fact that it's not predictable. But none of us feel particularly comfortable with the idea that, well, gosh, the five or six of us are going to sit up here as some kind of jury of reasonable persons rendering these decisions, because all of us, I mean, even when we disagree about the applications, would like some standard that we could look at and render, and that people would actually, you know, a vast majority of, at least, let's say, people who are trained in the area would be able to look at it and render opinion and do it reliably so.
Well, I would humbly submit that your complaint should be directed at Chief Justice Roberts and not at me. Chief Justice Roberts gave you that standard.
You have a phone number?
This ad, the Gansky ad, is not about the environment as an issue. It's about Gansky. And it's an attack on him. It's not an effort to lobby him. It doesn't even mention a piece of legislation. And, you know, this may be one of those ads where you're talking about a difference in degree as opposed to a difference in kind that makes the difference between an acceptable statement of a candidate's position on an issue versus condemnation of that individual, that candidate.
But isn't that kind of like the dues thing? I mean, in the sense that there's an easy way around it. Call Congressman Gansky, tell him to protect America's environment, tell him to support H.R. 1234.
Well, I'm not submitting that that's the only magical element, the mention or lack thereof of a piece of legislation, but when looking at the text of this ad, it certainly should not be.
Well, I understand, but the text of this ad would be changed materially. In other words, if you talked about his prior votes on environmental issues and how he basically, you know, voted wrong on the environment and how much that hurt the environment and the families in Iowa and so on like that, and that there was this bill pending that would make it all better, and calling him, tell him to support that, seems to me changes the character of the thing pretty dramatically.
Are you calling me unreasonable?
No, not at all. I'm just saying this is our problem in rendering this, and I'm trying
I understand
to see if you have
a
good solution.
You know, that's why we supported the bright line test of the statute, and we didn't advocate its curtailing or curtailment through the Supreme Court's decision, and I look forward to seeing how you do resolve these issues, but
yeah,
you know, the simple fact is that it is your burden and responsibility to.
Well, no, I'll just remind you that the tie goes to the speaker.
Well, that's what I wanted to get that, because we did lose that case. We lost the bright line, and we're living with the aftermath. And you had mentioned something which we've also struggled with internally, and part of what you're watching is sort of the debates and struggles we've had internally over how to interpret these things. And it goes to that question of the language in the decision where the Chief Justice talks about the tie going to the Speaker, and the question is, do we really need to find, you know, four votes to resolve whether this particular ad is or is not a protected speech, or does the presence of even a single reasonable voice teach us that that's the end of the inquiry and that we should approach these cases really significantly differently because of this notion that to the degree that one cannot clearly discern this, that the regulatory machinery must stop?
Well, when the question's posed to me, I'm the reasonable person. I'm in those shoes. To me, it's not a tie. So
but
if I were a commissioner, I would say, no, this is not a tie, and I would cast my vote for this ad not being exempt. And I don't think there's anything in the statute that created the commissions and the regulations that govern its procedures that, and perhaps you need a change in statute from Congress or a change in your regulations to say one vote is enough to block something. But the way the commission currently operates is it would be necessary for four commissioners to, in their own minds, view this as either a tie or as clearly susceptible to a reasonable interpretation other than as an attempt to influence an election. And then you've got four votes. but.
Well, certainly we'll have a statutory requirement that takes four votes to proceed in any matter, but in we're also interpreting a test which says that, you know, to the degree that a reasonable person can construe this as something other than a call to elect or defeat a candidate, then it's protected speech, and there appears to be a reasonable person sitting next to you at the table, and you sort of listen to those arguments. You don't believe that's the correct outcome, but it doesn't seem like the person who's, you know, voicing them is unreasonable, and doesn't that, under the Roberts test, lead you to conclude that a reasonable person has, in fact, construed this as something other than a call to vote for and against, and doesn't that, because of the nature of the test, have to guide your thinking about how you cast your vote?
Well, I mean, I certainly don't want to make this about the person sitting next to me at the table, but I'll stick to my initial position that I don't believe there's a reasonable interpretation other than, and it, to the extent some of your colleagues can convince you of otherwise and you change your mind and it pulls you from being here to on the fence to tie and then you change the way you want to vote, then so be it.
Okay, and I didn't mean to single you out as unreal. We actually do it with the people up here, too. Commissioner Weintraub, I guess.
This is a follow-up, so.
Let Commissioner Weintraub ask the question, okay. Then you can follow up.
Okay. And I'm deeply disappointed that the Vice Chairman doesn't appear to think that the five of us are the epitome of reasonable people. We are what they were thinking of when they invented the reasonable person test.
I don't think so. I have great affection for my colleagues and respect, too, but I do not think that's what they were thinking.
No?
I'm sure we
so
could all cite cases where the supportive Vice Chairman there.
I want to push Mr. Ryan a little bit on what he just said, that, you know, he doesn't think there's any way of reading this other than as a call to vote against Congressman Gansky. What if this precise text, word for word, no changes, is run in January of a non-election year, and there's a big environmental bill about to come up on the floor? Would you still say in with an election, you know, almost 2 years out, that running this ad, there's no reasonable way of interpreting it other than as a call to vote against him 2 years from now?
You know, that's a great alteration of the hypothetical or actual ad.
No, I'm not changing the words at all. I'm just seeing whether there's any way that these words can be read with a reasonable interpretation of something other than a call to vote against him.
You know, I'm going to say that given that I took context into such small consideration in rendering my initial opinion, I will say that that doesn't change the outcome, but I'm certainly willing to give it some thought I will take the same position that my predecessors on the previous panel who requested additional time to think about hypotheticals and changes that were not presented in the NPRM to perhaps get back to you. But my initial response is I wasn't taking proximity of the election into consideration when I was initially asked whether this is in or out. And so your shift of the hypothetical to further from the election, I would say initially that no, that doesn't change my response. That's the safe response for me.
Mr. Bob would applaud your lack of consideration of context. Ms. Robinson, then I'll. You sought recognition, it looked like, before.
Yes, but now I can't remember what it was about.
Happens to all of us.
It's been a long day.
Move on, and if it comes back to you, just give a signal. Commissioner Walther.
Well, I would just like to ask for the opinion of either one of you about guidance that we might get on ads that don't convey a verbal message, but by the image convey a very strong message. And you look at some of these ads, all that we talk about here is what we read and what we say. But in some cases, and I always hark back to some that I think are memorable who are old enough, about the Goldwater ad back in, I don't know what it would have been, 64, where they had this little girl picking petals off a flower, and in back of her was a mushroom cloud, and a black and white movie, and it sent a very dark, scary picture, and really, they made it all clear without even any words, pretty much what that was all about, given the context. But maybe it could have a word or two, and it could say, consider what Senator X is thinking about what you just saw. And now I'm just asking if you have any suggestions on how we could articulate how to take into those factors. I mean, the old adage is 1,000, one picture is worth 1,000 words. And certainly this is all about television that we're regulating or broadcast. But
Well, you know, in thinking about the Daisy ad,
And I think I remember the full thing, but I would have to say, in looking at that, it is not the functional equivalent of express advocacy.
Without just picking that up, how could we articulate powerful messages conveyed visually?
I suppose it would be the same way when you look at the text.
When the words are fairly anemic,
Right. It would be the same thing if you look at an ad with text. And you, in considering the four corners of that ad, does it convey to you a message that is something other than
functional equivalent of express advocacy?
Right.
So it could be we're really not going to talking about express advocacy done visually.
Right.
Essentially.
Right.
You know, I haven't really given much thought to the subject, and I will mention that Chief Justice Roberts' test itself uses the word an appeal, and it's open to interpretation as to whether an appeal can be made visually or must only be made verbally or through print communication. But you know, I think it's a very difficult question that I don't have an answer to. I think it would, and particularly with respect to the Daisy ad, the mushroom cloud ad.
Certainly one we would approach with a great deal of caution in the Fourth Circuit. Other questions, comments? General Counsel's Office, Staff Director's Side, anyone? Ms. Duncan.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to ask Ms. Robinson, in your written comments, you suggest including specific factors in the regulation that the commission may consider in determining if mm-hmm. an ad qualifies for the general exemption. And those factors seem to be fairly similar to the prongs of the grassroots lobbying safe harbor. I'm just wondering, as a matter of structure and form, why should we list the safe harbor prongs also as additional factors? Is there another benefit to doing that?
Well, I'm not sure that you should list all of the safe harbor prongs as additional factors, or whether I would conclude that there are some prongs of the safe harbor that may be left out in developing a safe harbor. As you pointed out, we did not avoid the hurly-burly of factors when we submitted our comments, but I think when we looked at those factors, it was as an attempt to explain to the commission in looking at the factors, it's a way to explain how more, even based on factors, can be included within, as Mr. Ryan calls it, the WRTL umbrella, than just those in the safe harbor.
Okay. Other questions? Comments? From our panelists, any final words?
No, okay. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. This concludes today's portion of our hearing. I want to express my thanks to our panelists for sticking with us today and devoting the time and energy necessary for all of this. We thank you. We will now recess and reconvene tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Thank you.